town in Honolulu. Mm-hmm. And at that particular time, there were other, Maui had a baseball team and they had a fair. So they combined the exhibition of, we were going to play the local team at the Maui Fair, which was a week-long thing. We got to stay 3 days in Maui. So, and then we went from there, we went to the Big Island of Hawaii. And we played another Marine team there, and then we played an air station there. And then we went to...
This is 42?
43.
43, okay.
Then we went to Kauai, and we played a team there. Mm-hmm. So we made a tour of all the islands. We didn't play on all of them, but we did go on all of them when we were gone for 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. And when we returned from this triumphant tour where we had won the league in Hawaii and Honolulu, and I had managed the team. Rafe's then took over the business end of it, and I managed the team. And we won. We went undefeated in the tour of the islands and put on a pretty good show every place we went. And when the plane landed, there was a Jeep waiting there, and it took myself and Rafe's and a Lieutenant Jackman in the Jeep and drove us on over. And I went right to personnel office, and they handed me orders to report aboard the USS Scorpion for transportation to Midway. So it then I found out that there was a fella who was a coach at a former coach at Harvard, and he was the one who requested that I be sent to Midway, which was the furthest advanced base that we had at that particular time.
And so you run the Scorpion.
Yeah, I was on the Scorpion, and then I transferred from the Scorpion to the submarine base at Midway, and I spent 6 months there.
And doing what?
We built a softball field, and it was an R&R stop for the submarines. See, what they would do, they would go out on a patrol, and then they would come back in. Instead of coming all the way into Pearl, they would stop and refit at the Midway, and they would be in for overhaul for 3 weeks at Midway, and then they'd turn out and go make another war patrol. And they, after every other war patrol, they would go back into Pearl for 30 days. Or they would go back to the States if they could possibly give them some type of relief. But at that particular time, we had practically no Navy, and the submarines were the entire Navy. And of course, again, this was the closest thing that we had to Japan, so it became necessary to make it a base. And then from there, the next base that they came up with was in Perth, Australia. Mm-hmm. But we made a softball field there out of the coral sand and used oil that we got from the airplanes over at the Marine Air Base that they had there. And it was a bird sanctuary, so there wasn't too much to do but watch the goonie birds land and take off. I did have an opportunity to read. I read a book a day all the time I was there. So,
did you supervise the construction of the field?
There wasn't any construction to it. You just laid down some, you had an oil truck with a leaker in the back of it, and we just went ahead and drove it around, and we thought we had enough oil, and we just took some little push types of like a rake, and we just pushed the coral sand over top of it until we got it about 4 inches thick. It was just like asphalt is what it was, and that was the diamond. Otherwise it would have blown away because it had wind blowing in there all the time, and there wasn't any vegetation hardly on the island, so all you had was just this what they called scabiola brush and one or two trees, and that was it. Rather desolate place.
Were the dimensions big league, or did long drives wind up in the ocean?
No, well, it could have. It was the island, of course, is very small. It's only about 3/4 mile wide and about a mile and a third, I guess, long, something like that. It's rather just in that tall, that's all.
I want to go back to the beginning for a minute. Where were you, and what were you doing when you got your induction notice? I take it this was in September 42?
Yeah. I didn't. I wasn't old enough to register in the first draft, and I had the first ticket pulled in the second draft. And we were playing in Philadelphia at the time that I registered. And I, so I had number one out of the Philadelphia draft board. And that was in July of 42. And, of course, I was married, so I had a deferment as far as that was concerned, but I knew it would be, wouldn't be too long to where they would get to the young married guys. So I went, started to investigate in Washington to find out. I went over and interviewed for the Hamilton program, or the V5 program. And, of course, I didn't have a degree, so they weren't interested. So then it was the TUNY program. And I took a written and oral examination for that and passed it. And so they then gave me the appointment, and then I got a deferment, tried to get a deferment till the end of the season, but they would only give me to the 15th of September. So I went to Norfolk for training, and then was stationed at Norfolk.
So you took your boot camp at Norfolk?
Yes.
Was Commodore McClure there then?
Yeah, yes.
Was
he was
Chief?
Captain McClure. Gary Bodie?
Chief Bodie, was
yeah.
he there then too?
Yeah.
Was he a chief petty officer or a chief warrant officer?
He was a chief petty officer at that time and became a warrant while he was there during that year. But he was a chief boatswain's mate when I got there.
So what you told me then is that you voluntarily went to the Navy. It wasn't a question of them saying to you, okay, you will go in the Navy.
No, I volunteered. At that time, you didn't have a draft for the Navy. No, it was a volunteer thing. I had to get a waiver from the medical department because I'm colorblind. And they gave me a bunch of tests. I guess they're just looking for a warm body. I don't know. But I went through the boot camp down there, and then I was stationed at the brig. And I used to go down there and build the soldiers every day. And then we started, it was Murray Franklin and Ray Volpe and myself. We were down at the brig. And then the first team we were going to play was Washington. They were coming north from spring training. And of course I was, being a Washington player, I lined up how to play each guy. And ironically, George had a lot to do with this. He was a dead pull hitter. And of course we shifted everybody over into a Williams type shift. And I was pitching against him, and George hit it down the right field line, hit a home run.
Oh, shit.
And he sealed my fate. That was it.
So, excuse me just for a second. Now, did you go through boot camp the way boot camp is normally gone through?
No.
Or did they send you right to the TUNY program, and you came out a chief?
Right. I was a chief when I went in. I was a chief specialist A. I was sworn in as a chief.
Oh, I see. So they were still doing that in those days?
Yeah, but I just put the program together. And it wasn't something that... it had only been in existence, I think, about 4 or 5 months at that time.
Well, I know the feller, I think, went in December of 41, and they made him an instant chief. They made Sam Chapman an instant chief.
Mm-hmm.
And I think Freddie Hutchinson.
Yes. So I was all part of the same parcel.
Oh, okay, fine.
So, there was a man by the name of Admiral English. I don't know whether his name has come up with you or not.
No, well, you mentioned him before,
yeah.
And I wanted to know more about
and
him.
He was the man who first hit upon the idea of having professional athletes go into the advanced theaters. If you will, something other than USO, because they couldn't take women into the particular area, and they thought, well, the next best thing to keep people's minds off of what was happening was to keep them occupied with sports.
Mm-hmm.
And he was the one who, of course, there was a lot of publicity about Hutchison and Feller. And, of course, Feller was forced to leave Norfolk because of the publicity. And
well, tell me about that. I've never heard that before.
Well, it was, they said the reports came back that Feller was being protected and not taking his chances like everybody else, and citizenry objected to it.
So does this explain why he wound up in a gun crew in Alabama?
Right, absolutely.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. And he was waiting for the Iowa that was under construction, of course, was his native state. Mm-hmm. And he was going to go on to the Iowa, but the heat got so bad that the only battle wagon that they had ready at that particular time was the Alabama, and he went aboard the Alabama. They just forced him out of Norfolk. That was it. He had been there 1 year.
Okay, now just to backtrack again, that means that you were playing ball for Norfolk in the spring of 43.
Right.
But you didn't last the full season.
No,
and neither
only one
did
game.
Miller. Only one game, and that was against the Senators, mm-hmm. and you lost that game.
Mm-hmm.
Can you give me the composition of the team at that time?
Which team?
The Norfolk team, the day you pitched. Were there any other major leaguers besides you and Feller there?
Yeah, there was Eddie Robinson was the first baseman. Let's see, Robinson, DeVores, Rizzuto, Jimmy Carlin, Finney Smith was the catcher, Don Padgett, Dominic DiMaggio.
Were Casey and Reese there by that time?
They were at the Air Force. Air Station. They had just gotten there that spring. See, I was there in September, October, November, right cleaning through the winter, and then they came in the spring.
And Bodie was managing?
Bodie was not managing the Air Station. He was managing the training station.
Right, yeah.
Yes, he was managing. And that was when McClure was running the operation there, through Bodie. And then English came on with this directive through Washington that some players were going to have to go. That was it. They demanded that some be sent to an advanced base. So Boney came up with a proposition. He solicited among the ball players, would anybody be interested in any of these jobs? Of course, one of them was at the receiving station in Washington, D.C. Well, that would have meant that I would have lived at home with commuted rations and everything and probably would have rode out the entire war in Washington. Well, I immediately put down, I want to go, which was the kiss of death. And, of course, I had other people who did the same thing, four of us, and we were the four but weren't wise enough to recognize that there was a put-on, that he was looking for guys who didn't want to stay there. So he put us on the draft to go to Pearl Harbor to the submarine base.
Wait a minute, let me get this straight. The psychology was that if you hadn't put in for it, but instead say, hey, I want to stay in Norfolk, you might have stayed.
You were great, yes, you stayed.
So as a result of putting in for Washington, you got sent to Hawaii.
Right. So, and there were four of us. There was Jimmy Gleason, who you know was a coach with Yogi and
got a letter from him last week.
Yes, a scout living at the Golden Arrow Inn in Kansas City.
We can discuss that later. I don't know what that is.
Well, he owns a quite a bit of real estate there that his mother had purchased for him when he was playing ball. And the Golden Arrow Inn is a tavern which he owns, and he owns a theater and a filling station and several other things there. But it was Jimmy and Chuck Medler, who's
a Penn State,
and Ray Volpe.
Right, now, who is Volpe? What was he doing? Was he a baseball player?
Yes, he was with the Yankees. He was in Pittsburgh, Kansas City.
Oh. Where did he come from? I know nothing.
New York. He's a native New Yorker. He was a police trainee, a graduate of Manhattan.
Yeah.
And a phys ed major, and he was in the Yankee chain.
Okay.
Well, but Volpe had a bad arm, and Medler had a bad arm.
Okay, now what was Medler's background?
He was with Detroit. He was a Penn State, three-letter man at Penn State. And I think he was at Beaumont, I'm not sure, but either Beaumont or Toledo, one of the higher farm teams that Detroit had at that particular time.
So we're talking about three pitchers in Gleason and outfield.
Right.
Okay, that's right.
So anyhow, we're on our way to Pearl Harbor, and English's plane crashed in Alaska. And, of course, here we arrive on the scene, and nobody knows what to do with us. But my order said to go directly to the submarine base, and we were not on a draft. We went on individual orders.
English was killed in the plane crash?
Yes. So when I arrived, why, I went through the regular procedure, going over to the submarine base and reporting in to personnel and going over to the chief's quarters and getting assigned a bunk. And so I sat around for 2 days and no one knew what to do, and I got a call to go down to the engineering repair department. And I went down there and I met this commander, Lieutenant Commander Tom Eddy. And he asked me, would I play ball? And I told him, you know, great, be great with me. And he tried to explain it as best he could. And he told me that Rafe's was running everything, to go look up Rafe's, which I did. And so that's how the thing came about. And then after the rest of the fellows got there, and some of them didn't come for 2 months, I had been there 2 months when they arrived on the scene. I didn't know, I was very naive and didn't know how you could delay in making a transfer. I could have gotten lost anywhere along the line, which the other three did. But I figured I'd go by the letter of the law, and I left the next day from Norfolk and took off, went right to Treasure Island, and from there right on to the Hayes and right on to Pearl Harbor.
Okay, now what happened to the other three? I know they got there eventually, but...
I don't know. They each went their separate ways. They all went home, I know that. And
no, but did they all eventually make it out?
Oh, yeah. They all made it there.
Yeah.
So we played there that year, and then, of course, I told you about the going aboard the Scorpion and winding up at Midway. So then I spent 6 months on Midway, and the season was about to begin back in Hawaii at Honolulu.
Okay, now this takes us up to the spring of 44.
Yeah.
Okay, now the sub base... won the championship of the Hawaii League in 43.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm going to try and pin you down as far as the chronology so I can figure out exactly, you know, what you were in on and what you weren't as far as baseball is concerned. When did you board the Scorpion? You remember the month and year? Or to put another way, did you play the entire 43 baseball season out there in Honolulu?
It was a day after the season, after the tour of the islands. And the season's finished Labor Day, because they were coming along with a barefoot football.
I'm sorry, that wasn't clear in my mind. Okay,
yeah,
go ahead.
And I spent October, November, December, January, February, March on Midway.
Okay.
And then I got a PBM and flew out of Midway and came back back to the sub base. And of course, when I reported back to the sub base, I immediately went down to Tom Eddy's office and I said, "Hey, you know what you did to me? I'm not leaving. I'm not doing anything until you get me back to the States." I said, "That's it." I said, "After what you've done to me, if you're going to ask me to do something for you, no way. You pay back what you've done to me. You asked me to run your ball club. I was voted the outstanding athlete in Hawaiian Islands. I allowed one run in 11 games and all this kind of junk. I mean, well, it should have been. I mean, they're like a bunch of kids, you know, compared to major league players. But I refused to go on duty or anything else. I sat in his office for 2 days. So finally he came in and he handed me some orders. I had been transferred aboard the USS Tuna for reassignment. So I went down and went aboard the Tuna, and I found the Tuna was going back in, or I beg your pardon, it was the Seawolf, not the Tuna. And the Seawolf was going back in for overhaul at Mare Island. So that meant that I automatically got a 30-day leave when I hit there and then came back. Well, then, when I got to Mare Island, I was assigned in the ship's company as a chief in charge. And all they did, they left half the, or a quarter of the crew there, and the other three-quarters of the crew went on leave.
Did you go on leave?
No. So then... I had learned enough then, you know, I'd been in the Navy long enough to find out how to get around. Then I found out that they weren't going to give me a leave. Well, I had gotten word to my wife to meet me in San Francisco, and she got there the same day I got there, and we met at Shep Medler's apartment. And we stayed there for a couple of days, and then I found out that what they were going to do, that just as soon as the another submarine was leaving, they were going to put me aboard there and take me back to Pearl Harbor. So I left the O'Doyle. I had been playing with some of the fellows around in the San Francisco area on a local made-up team. We were playing exhibitions all around in the San Francisco area, and I got to Lefty, and Lefty got to a friend of his who was in the Navy there and got me transferred from the submarine base down to Hunter's Point, which is in a dry dock in South San Francisco. Okay. The last submarine is coming out of dry dock. It's a USS Tuna. And my wife is working in the office, and I'm in charge of athletic program at Hunter's Point, and Hunter's Point is going to close down for 6 months, not going to do anything. So I was more or less was going to be in mothballs, so I was going to be on furlough in San Francisco for 6 months.
Stan, excuse me, at this point, I take it your wife was living in Philadelphia?
No, she was in Washington.
Oh, Washington. She came out, left Washington, came out, got a job in San Francisco.
Right.
So that you and her could be together.
Yeah.
Okay.
In fact, the people on the base gave us a brand new apartment, completely furnished, gave her transportation. Oh, it was a number one setup. A slob on the Tuna, a first class boatswain mate, takes a gun and shoots himself in the foot.
So he won't have to go on patrol.
Right. There are 2 hours. They come up to the base to get a qualified man.
And you're it.
I'm it. So away I went.
Okay, now
back to the sub base in Pearl Harbor, see? So.
Your wife's probably crying her heart out.
And she's pregnant.
Oof.
So, I just had time to go home and pack my bag, and I called her, and she came home, and we were getting about 15, 20 minutes, and that was it. When I got there, I immediately went up to the personnel office, and I said, all right, get me off. We had some problems. The officer was a makeshift crew. The diving officer was a washed-out Air Force pilot. The captain was a force striper. His name was Holy Joe Harden, and he used to walk around with the Bible in his hand. And it's very unusual to have a force striper skipper of a submarine. But he was going after a Navy cross, and he was going to change the world with his Bible. And they dove one time and left another fellow and myself up in the A-frames. And we just about got out of that, and I got a broken nose out of that deal. And a lot of other things happened. We were servicing from a dive, and the diving officer got excited and wouldn't secure bow buoyancy, and we almost backed down on the screws, and that would have been it. There were a lot of things that happened.
You said you got a broken nose in the A-frames. What are the A-frames, and did you get a broken nose in the pressure differential?
No. The wind was blowing, and it was a day like this, and it was nighttime, and they had what they call the periscope shears. At those particular times, they had frame resembled an A, and the periscopes right out of the conning tower were up in here, and they were braced in these frames. Now on either side you had a lookout. You had an after lookout and a forward lookout, and you had two lookouts up in these A-frames, and you leaned up against the periscope shears, and they had a semicircular thing for your feet and another one for your arms, and you held the glasses up. You were a half hour up, half hour down, half hour messenger, and back up again on the other side. And what happens when you come up out of the submarine, you ask for permission to come on the bridge. And when you come up, there's a chalk there, and the diving officer, when he gives you permission, puts a mark on the slate that they have right there on the bridge. So he knows exactly how many people are up there. And when they give the command to dive, he puts out his hand, and as you go by, you hit it. So he just slashes off, and when everybody's gone, well, then he goes. So evidently radar picked up something, and I don't know what went on. But the wind was blowing like hell, and I thought I heard something, and I wasn't sure. But they forbid you to take the glasses down. But I don't know what it was. I pulled the glasses out, and peripheral vision, I saw the after lookout going for the hatch. When I pulled the glasses out, looked down, the diving officer was gone. And the after lookout was gone. It was just me and this other fellow. So I didn't even wait. I just dropped everything, and I jumped, which is about 8 feet, down onto the bridge. And then I had a duck to go under the bridge to go into the conning tower. It was another hatch. Well, just as I was going under, the other guy hollered, "Let's go." He didn't realize what was happening. And the bow had already gone under. And he jumped, and he hit me in the back, and I got the hatch in the face. So I fell down into the conning tower. And, of course, this guy came right down and back of me, and they secured the hatch. And, of course, there was the executive officer was up there, the captain was up there, the coxswain was up there, or the helmsman, and the other lookout and myself. Well, there was just too many people in there. So they started hollering, "Clear the conning tower, clear the conning tower." And everybody's saying, "I'm all bashed up, and my nose and blood's going all over the place." And they pushed me over, and I rolled, and when I rolled, I went down in the hatch, fell down through the hatch into the control room. My leg got hung on a ladder, and I flipped over backwards. And I was hanging there upside down. And I'm cussing and screaming and hollering, you know. And, of course, the pharmacist mate came over, and they got me down and patched me up and everything. And the captain came down out of the conning tower, and he looked at me in kind of a sneery kind of a way. And, man, I lit into it. I called him everything I could lay my tongue to. I told him, I said, "You know, I never saw such a bunch of misfits in all my life, and just as soon as this thing hit ground anywhere, I was getting the hell off whether he liked it or not." So, anyhow, I did.
Okay, so, yeah, okay, so what happened? Where did the tuna go?
Well, eventually, the chief of the boat, they used it as a landing barge in Manila. Ironically, they ran aground down there.
But did you go to Manila with it?
No, I got off. Just as soon as it hit, as soon as they pulled into the Finger Pier, I went over the side. Right then. I didn't wait for anybody. I didn't wait for them to put the gangplank over. I jumped and got off of it.
Yeah, but I mean, you could have been putting the pokey in the brig.
I was better there than dead.
Okay, but no one said anything?
No, nobody said anything.
It must have been Eddie who intervened for
it. Yeah, well, he was the number one man because he was doing all the producing. So, anyhow, of course, in the meantime, I had told Commander Eddie that the fellows that we had playing ball couldn't work all day and play ball all night. Just an impossibility. So we had them all broken into half schedules, and we had everybody that we could, whose qualifications would fit, we had to move into the engineering department. And we more or less operated the athletic. We had no athletic officer, and we had no athletic officer to sub-base. So then I prevailed on him to get everybody together, and that's when we got the barge. And, of course, the first barge was kind of rickety and not too good. And then we lived on that for about 8 weeks, I guess. And then here came a brand spanking new one. And that was quite a deal. And, of course, we had all the players then on the barge. And we had our own cook and our own mess cooks and everything. We bought our own food. And we were set up on a separate deal, which was real good.
And what did they do? Did they build housing on top of the...
No, it was a repair barge.
Oh, okay.
Now, in a submarine...
So the superstructure, if you will, of the barge was already there.
It was a work barge, is what it was, and had room in there for 100 men. And, let's see...
Bunks, the whole bit.
There was 8 officers and 100 men. And, of course, the facilities for everyone right there. And we just tied up to the... right there, right side of the ballpark, and... We were right in action, but we could come and go because we had all these dizzy schedules, and we were in 3 leagues, and we had gone all different ways. So anyhow, we played that year, and then the end of that year, that's when we played the Army Navy World Series. That's when the Seabees built the ballpark, and I think it was a week or two, built a whole brand new ballpark. Right from absolutely nothing. They did a fantastic...
Now wait, do you mean to say the Furlong Field, the district field, was built for that series?
Yeah, right. Yeah, they put it up in about 2 weeks, I think.
And I understand that the Seabees also created that mound of dirt outside the right field foul line, and that they allowed only Seabees to sit on it.
Yeah.
Is that true? That's what Ferrick said.
I
have it in the films. The films I got from the National Archives shows this huge mound of dirt about halfway down the right field line, and guys are sitting on top of it.
Well, it's quite possible. I didn't remember that. Anyhow, when we got back, I had orders to report aboard the USS Apollo that day.
September.
Yeah. So I went aboard the Apollo, and I said, where are we going? So they said, well, we're going to relieve the Wharton at Perth. So we're going to Australia. And that was a little hairy, the run that we made. Anyhow, we went into Guam instead.
Okay, now give me a month and a year on this. Is this right after the service?
Exactly the same situation that happened the year prior to it. Where
as soon as you're done,
the tour of the islands was murder for me.
Wow.
I did have one real grand thing. I was a guest of Mr. Chu Baldwin at his house for a week on Maui. He owned the island. His family owned the island. And that was my first taste of palatial splendor. I had never seen or ever dreamed that there was anything like that in my whole life. That was very, very wonderful and a good memory. But again, when I returned, and the Apollo, of course, was shoving off the next day. So I served on the Apollo and then was attached to her, and we pulled into Guam, and office. They had an office set up on the beach there, and there was another tender coming in, the Proteus. So they were on one side of the pier, and we were on the other side of the pier, and that was the advanced base then. They had taken a lot of action away from Midway, and a lot of it was moving down in that particular area. And then Red and I went out in a Jeep, and they told us to go scout this particular area, and there were